If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
It's the start of the Wintrust business lunch. A very happy Tuesday afternoon. We heard Steve mention stocks are down after, you know, a couple weeks of very flat results on the markets. In the last hour, I mentioned Eric Zorn, the jobs I didn't want. I want to add one more to it. The president of the Fed. They're in a tough spot. They have been for the past couple of years. Philip Shaw joins us now. He's the senior advisor at Goldstone Financial Group. Philip, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I just feel like the Fed is in a caught between a rock and a hard place, right? Inflation is going down, but it's still higher than we wanted. They've sort of prognosticated they want to go up a little bit more with the rates, but as they fear a recession coming, it's almost like, boy, how much further can you go up and really throw a wrench in this stuff? They really have a tough decision to make, don't they, coming up?
Yeah, they really do. And to your point, between a rock and a hard place, is it's almost like a little bit of short-term pain for a long-term outlook on this. Is inflation is going to be a really big issue if they don't get this under control, which is why the Fed has been saying that most likely rates are going to be higher for longer than people expect. Their hope is that they don't really push us into a recession, but it's becoming more likely every time they raise rates.
Yeah, it's almost like if they know a recession is coming, which of course no one does, if it's mild, it's almost like they weigh the idea of, hey, a mild recession, no good, but better than sticky inflation for another 2, 3, 4 years, right? And that's a tough choice that they have to make.
Oh, and that's exactly what they're going through. And they've been pretty vocal about this from the onset. Is saying we are planning on slowing down the economy. And that's really what recession is. It's not a crash per se. You know, everyone gets this idea of the last recession being what the next one will look like. And this is not going to be a 2008 kind of, you know, crash of the economy, crash of the market. A recession just means we've actually slowed down for 2 quarters in a row.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be hard to know exactly where we are until we get there, but they'll certainly take that, you know, a slighter dip than the pains of what we saw in the late 70s and early 80s, because that can really mess up people's financial futures.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Trying to avoid that sticky inflation is their first priority right now, much more than keeping us out of a recession.
For sure. You know, we've talked a lot about, I also host the Your Money Matters program at 6 o'clock Monday through Thursday, shameless plug. And we talk a lot about financial literacy and how important that is to newer generations. And I often applaud certain TikTokers or Instagram reelers who make videos trying to tell the lessons of compounding interest or get into young people's minds some good, sound financial advice. But as you point out, there's a dangerous side to that, isn't there, on social media?
Yeah, there really is, and it's important to know who you're talking to or who you're listening to when you're going out looking for social media financial advice. You know, it's Gen Z and millennials are the, you know, probably the biggest consumers of that kind of social media financial advice. But it's important to know, is the person you're talking to actually a licensed financial advisor? Do they have your best interests at heart? Do they have conflicts? It's really difficult to see that, you know, just with the average, you know, TikToker, as you say.
Do you think that someone has to be a financial advisor on social media to give good advice? Or are you just suggesting, hey, look, know where the information's coming from so you can plan accordingly?
No, I agree with you. I don't think somebody needs to be a financial advisor. But there's a lot of important reasons why our industry has regulations. You know, for example, if I have a conflict of interest with a client, I can't sell somebody a stock per se and then run the price up and sell it. You know, the reason that we have some of these protections is so that you know, hey, where is the advice coming from? What is this person's, you know, interest in giving me advice? Do they have a conflict with me somewhere? And so, you know, if they're not regulated, if they're not licensed, it's not necessarily they're giving you bad advice. But you should at least be aware of, hey, what's the incentive where is their advice coming from?
Right. And it's also, there's such a difference between financial literacy, right? Like me explaining T-bills on TikTok versus here's how you get rich quick. So you kind of have to pay attention to the message just as much as the messenger.
Yeah, absolutely. And anybody that's telling you that they have a get-rich-quick scheme, I'd be very wary of anyone that says they know exactly what the market's going to do, if they know exactly what, you know, some investment's going to perform for you. I'd be very careful about that. You know, the biggest thing in becoming wealthy over time is investing and having a lot of time on your side.
Yeah.
Not finding the winning lottery ticket.
Amen there. Philip Shaw, Senior Advisor, Goldstone Financial Group, goldstonefinancialgroup.com. Thanks for your time, Philip.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I want to ask this question genuinely, and you can text on in the answer. 312-981-7200. Is your boss better than they were before? Have they gotten less anxious? They're not harassing you as much anymore in terms of being so demanding? Well, it may not be an accident. Philip Weiss from Seyfarth joins us, seyfarthatwork.com. And Philip, a lot of bosses either got the memo or were told to get the memo to be better at their jobs. And it seems like they're trying.
Yeah, they are trying. And those that are not succeeding, John, are being given extra help. And that may be part of the picture that we're starting to see in terms of managers, as you say, getting the memo, getting the skills, and getting more aware. If you look at the coaching industry, that is people brought in, third parties brought in, to give managers the tools, skills, sometimes even read them the Riot Act, that industry has really blown up. It's grown by about 60 to 70% in the last couple of years, and we see headlines all the time of managers going off the rails. That even spurs companies to be more proactive,
yeah,
to bring managers into coaching faster. So we're seeing a lot of focus in this area. Time will tell how effective it is across industries.
I want to give upper management a big kudos here for encouraging this. But then I wonder, are they just speaking with their wallets? Is the labor market so tight and people had so many options for so long to leave that they are simply responding to the fact that too many of their talent are quitting and leaving because of bad bosses?
Yeah, I think it is a mixed bag. It's a combination of factors, John, because in some cases, with the social media spotlight on any mistakes made by managers, and a lot of these mistakes, by the way, are made over Zoom, over virtual meetings, and are recorded and then broadcast. Companies are, in fact, in some cases, doing what they have to do simply to protect themselves and, as you say, the retention of managers and employees. In other cases, it is actually a well-intentioned endeavor. That is to say, a lot of people retired, as you know, during the pandemic. They sort of saw the light in terms of their own priorities. That led other people to move up the ladder more quickly than anticipated. And companies said, we need to get those people the right kind of top-line management skills. So it can be a prevention or reaction thing. It can also be an intent to help people lead with more clarity and impact. So we're seeing it coming from many different directions.
What happens in a coaching session with a manager? Like, I feel like, what are some, like, concrete examples of things that they are taught?
Yeah, well, it entirely depends on the nature of the session. So the reality is, if you've got someone who is trying to be executive material, and she or he is willingly coming to the session, it's a fairly straightforward process. They're given tools, they're given a few examples, they're asked for their own goals, and then a sort of a map is charted out between them and the coach. It's far more complicated, John, if the person is an unwilling participant because it's their bad behavior that brought them to the table. Then it's really four or five steps. The coaching subject is allowed to vent because they often have got their own view of things. They're shown the impact of their conduct in the moment, and they're asked to identify the first moment when what they did or said veered off a respect standard. So it's really a multi-level process. In some cases, John, we've had people that our team has coached, they realized, you know what, I've been treating my spouse poorly, my kids poorly, my friends. It can be a sort of a coming to realization process and very eye-opening for some subjects.
Interesting. So the psychological factors that may make people bad bosses may be so ingrained in them that they are bad spouses too.
That's right. We had a gentleman. He actually, by his third, it was a three-session process because he had a lot of issues he wanted and needed to confront. He said, "I got to stop drinking. I'm going to change my schedule. I'm going to go talk to my wife right after this because I've got to reset on many levels." And what's fascinating, John, is whether it's a positive process or kind of remedial, the end is always the same. It is the coaching subject themselves articulating what will they do next, what will they do differently. So they have to own the process, whether it is imposed or voluntarily participated in.
Do you charge double for that one then?
Well, you know, we did not.
Okay,
because frankly, we saw ethically problematic, but B, you know, if you do a good job with these, the calls keep coming in, to be honest.
Because yeah.
These are two strike situations for the person, John. The individual doesn't know where to turn, and then they realize no matter where I go to work, I'm going to face the same rules. So being able to turn that corner is resonates so positively for them and for the company.
People right now are texting, some saying, my manager is currently the worst I've had in 40 years. That's a delicate situation, but does upper management want to know how the employees feel about middle management? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, it's a delicate situation to go to HR and complain about a boss. You got to have some legitimate gripes. But should people be doing that simply to make sure everyone knows what's happening?
The short answer is absolutely. And really, it's up to the companies to create a environment and send messages that let people know we have a team that is credible, that is high enough level, and that is tasked with intaking that information so that we can protect you, the environment, the process, and we can address those bad actors, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important to have credibility in how you investigate. And people, while they may not hear all the facts about what happened, they should see the change happening. The companies that do well are those that realize, I'd rather have this brought up internally now than brought up externally in a courtroom 3 years from now. So encouraging people raising the issues and having a really, really positive, credible process to address it are essential today.
847 texted, and you can complain about management on Glassdoor. Does management read things like that, like Glassdoor apps or websites where people can review how the experience was working there?
Yeah, it depends on the company. In some cases, absolutely. They're almost like fixated on what is said regarding the leadership or the organization. In other cases, it might be that executives themselves, they want to actually hear directly from their employees, and they're quite aware of how some employees have approached them, have sent them emails, have raised issues. Again, the idea is you want to be clear that you have processes so that people are encouraged not to go online, not to go to a lawyer, but to let you know about it because you do want to address it. It builds so much trust in the company. We had a client, and the CEO came in and said, our reputation is more important than any one client or customer. So if you are treated differently or badly by a customer, client, or your manager, go to the head of HR. Go to a key person in compliance. Go to a lawyer within our company. We want to know about it. That kind of buy-in and that kind of assuming responsibility can make a tremendous difference.
Philip Weiss, SciFarthAtWork.com. Thanks for joining us as always. We appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thanks a lot, John.
Absolutely. AI has certainly been in the news in recent weeks, months, and years, will continue to be so. Sultan Meghji, who used to run or be part of the FDIC, now a professor at Duke University. Sultan, thanks for hopping on with us here today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to hear your voice.
Oh, yes. And AI, of course, is just, ever since ChatGPT became something that people discovered and started using, is forefront in a lot of conversations. Would you argue that it's weeks, months, or years away from really changing the way work is done in this country?
You know, it's interesting. I was having this conversation a few minutes ago because I think we need to think about it in a different way. AI has been impacting the way we work just, you know, one or two steps removed from our daily lives, but I think it's there. In the last 90 days, the amount of enabling technology that has being able to be put in the hands of normal people has radically altered work. I'll give you a great example. So I'm writing my curriculum for the fall term for an introductory class for a graduate computer science program at Duke. Usually that takes me about a day to build. I did it in about an hour using ChatGPT.
Yep. It's amazing. And I mean, and so then riddle me this. Is ChatGPT or other AI going to take away jobs, or will it take away the jobs from people who are unwilling to learn it and use it?
Well, the latter is definitely true. You know, this just like, you know, 25, 30 years ago, people started using word processors. And if you could adapt to word processors and spreadsheets, all of a sudden, if you were using a slide rule or a typewriter, your job changed quite a bit. So we're going to see another version of that where you're not typing into a keyboard to write a document anymore. You're telling an AI to write the document for you. So that's the first part. The second is we absolutely are going to see jobs go away and change because of AI. But that's not new. That's been going on for a while. You know, 20 years ago, I ran a software development group, and we had 150 guys who did quality assurance. Nowadays, I would not need 150 guys to do quality assurance. I would need 20 or so. And we're going to see the same thing, but it's going to be far broader than just, you know, narrow technical jobs. It's going to be in every aspect of our economy.
Who leads the globe in terms of AI production? Are we leaders in that in the United States?
It's a great question. It's not clear that there is a leader just yet. Certainly, there's been a lot of talk about companies like OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, and a few others. But, you know, there are a lot of companies in China doing a lot of work, a lot of companies in Europe. I think it's good to see American innovation leading. I'm not convinced that 2 or 3 years from now that'll still be the case.
Ethically, there's a lot of questions as well. And AI, like you said, I mean, AI is a part of our life. Facial recognition. I know that some businesses, you know, when the places that like find you jobs, right, like some of these big box companies, they don't read your resumes individually. They send it through a program that does so. But there's a lot of questions about even biases that are in those programs. Does there need to be more regulation, or are the octogenarians that we've been talking about in the House and Senate the last people that should be touching anything that has to do with this new technology?
Oh, you ask the best questions. And I actually would take what you said and break it into two questions. One is there bias in technology? Well, of course, people have bias and they build technology. So until we can remove bias from the hearts and minds of humanity, there will be bias both in humanity and technology. You know, just a few minutes ago, a number of U.S. federal regulators, including the CFPB, the FTC, and others, basically said that they already have the power to regulate any company using AI that has demonstrated bias. So this breaking news, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say that there is a worrying trend that I see in Washington, D.C., of taking old laws and applying them to new technologies.
Right.
We see it in the banking sector. We see it in, you know, we see it in finance. We see it in healthcare. And I worry that there's just so much fear in certain circles about AI that they're going to stifle it here in the United States, and the rest of the world is just going to shoot right past us. And we're going to end up living in the 1990s when everyone else is living in the 2030s.
But there's a concern that no regulation or checks on biases, and maybe those checks on a bias or a fault in AI, the market will figure it out, right? You're going to choose ones that don't have it. Companies will, or whatever it may be. You can't simply ignore that there's those biases and the ethical questions about AI in general. I mean, these are profound things that we need to tackle, whether it's at the political level or the marketplace level, is where I think a lot of people oscillate between.
Well, it's a great point, and I agree completely. Do we need regulation? Yes, but we need regulation that understands that it's a fast-moving market, that this is a dynamic environment we're living in. The technology is moving unbelievably quickly. You know, I started using a piece of technology called AlterGPT about 2.5-3 weeks ago, and it's fundamentally altered my life. I am
already in two or three weeks.
I'm 3 or 4 times more productive in my daily life because I'm using this piece of technology. It's an open source project, too. I didn't pay a penny for it. But, you know, regulations is not just about saying, no, you can't do something. Good regulation also says, and this is how we say yes. here are the environments where you can be innovative. Here are the environments where we want to encourage activity in the space. And the problem that we have right now in DC in particular is that most regulators are just people who say no. And I worry that they don't really understand that this is not something you're going to be able to say no to. It will fundamentally harm our country for the next century if regulations like what we're seeing in other parts of the sector are applied to AI in the exact same way.
I want to, you know, expand even outside of the business world. I admitted this on Your Money Matters. It was really embarrassing to do so, but I'm going to. The news of ChatGPT and it reaching mainstream happened right around simultaneously at the time that my godfather, my uncle, passed away. And I was going to say a few remarks. And just for the mental exercise, I plugged into ChatGPT a few details about writing a eulogy about your uncle who used to take you fishing. And I didn't use it, but I will say what it spit out gave me a couple interesting points that maybe I felt that I didn't even know, and it put it so succinctly. I'm not saying go write your eulogies using ChatGPT, but maybe that's an example of it can give you a starting place for some of these ideas. It can remind you of new ways of saying things that you just can't quite get out in your own words. It was fascinating, Sultan.
Yeah. Well, first off, I'm sorry for your loss. That's a tough one to take. You know, I think you're exactly right. I was actually at a eulogy for someone who the main speaker admitted, and this is right when it happened, that he had ChatGPT write it and then he edited it.
Right.
And so, you know, this is you know, and writer's block for those of us who have to write. You know, sometimes it just hits you, whether it's, you know, you about to get on air to do, you know, a show like this, or me writing a class, or writing a eulogy or whatever. And, you know, we're at a moment where technology has gotten to a point where the foibles of our personalities, of our brains in any given moment, we can use technology to work through that. And we're seeing very early use cases of it now with things like ChatGPT. That's going to evolve over time when, you know, it's not just an AI that shows you the fastest way to drive to work or, you know, what to write, but it's, you know, I sat down the other day and I wrote a white paper on a regulatory topic, actually, and it was terrible. I just, I got the points across, but it was not a good piece of writing. And this morning I sat down, you know, got a cup of coffee, sat down on my laptop, my ChatGPT window is always open now. I copied and pasted it in there and said, please, can you write this so it's much better and put some humor in it, stuff like that. And it took a factually correct 60% finished piece of work and handed back to me a 90% finished, much better written piece of work that I edited in a half hour. And then, boom, I was finished.
It's amazing. Sultan, I wish we could talk more. We are out of time. I do think that's a good lesson for people. Just try it. See what it can do for you before you knock it and instantly hate it. I think that we could probably say that for every technology over the last 200 years. But Sultan Meghji, I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us, okay?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll do it again soon. Great conversation there. Really fascinating stuff. We did just hear that Kim Fox has announced that she is not running officially for state's attorney. It had been rumored, and we talked about it earlier in the show. Just wanted to update folks on that. More on that a little bit later on. Time for a look at some more business news in the Wintrust Business Minute. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A developer has outlined plans for turning Baxter International's Deerfield campus into an industrial park. The 101-acre site currently includes 10 office buildings that will be torn down to develop 3 industrial warehouses. Village leaders are set to take a key vote on the project this week, according to Cranes. Deerfield's Planning Commission has a meeting scheduled for Thursday. The project is being developed by Bridge International. In addition to the warehouses, the site would include a recreational facility, including an indoor soccer field, youth baseball field, and outdoor pickleball courts. Fans of Home Run Inn Pizza can now buy just the crust. The company's newest product is called Nothing But Crust. The idea is to let customers build their own pizzas with Home Run Inn crust as the foundation. A 2-pack of Nothing But Crust costs $10 at Jewel. The product's available in the frozen section. Home Run Inn is headquartered in Woodridge. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And Steve Alexander with the business of food.
And we're happy to be sponsored today by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. A while back, I featured a Chicago company that's making seafood without the sea or anything that comes out of the sea. Aquacultured Foods is growing fungi at its West Loop headquarters to create seafood-like items like shrimp and fish fillets, which reminded me of this woman.
Sylvia Wolf. I'm president and CEO of Aqua Bounty Technologies.
Yeah, about a year ago, Sylvia joined us to talk about the opening of Aqua Bounty's new salmon farm in Albany, Indiana. How about an update?
Certainly. Its total capacity is about 1,200 metric tons. We've made it through COVID, and we now have our 15th cohort of fish being farmed in that facility.
The salmon start out as eggs, roe, which come from Aqua Bounty's facility in Canada,
which we have converted completely to broodstock. So that will give us the ability to be vertically integrated and meet all our internal demand for eggs.
And from the time the eggs arrive in Indiana until they're ready for your plate?
It's roughly 18 to 20 months.
And there's a very good chance that the salmon from Indiana has wound up on your plate here in Chicago.
Think about restaurants, hotels. That's where we're focused right now, not at retail.
Sylvia says most of the salmon we eat is farm-raised and most of it is imported, which worked until the pandemic.
And when the supply chain shut down, having a domestic source of supply has become increasingly important to both our customers and to consumers.
And there's more salmon to come.
We've now begun construction on a much larger scale, state-of-the-art farm right outside of Toledo in Pioneer, Ohio.
And if you're thinking that farm-raised salmon is somehow inferior to wild-caught salmon?
The salmon that is farmed has the same nutritional benefits as wild salmon.
Anything else on the menu?
Yes. The next opportunity for us is another species, which would be shrimp.
So the next time you're at a Chicago area restaurant or banquet, that salmon or shrimp could be from Indiana or Ohio. From the farm to your belly. It's early for this part of the world, but today is National Zucchini Bread Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
That's right. We got a great conversation here with Gretchen Grad, who is the founder of Hands of Peace, which is an incredible organization bringing American, Israeli, and Palestinian teens together. Gretchen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing terrific. Good to be here.
So excited to chat with you. And reading about the mission, bringing American, Israeli, and Palestinian teens together, you started this. Why did you start this organization?
I started it in the wake of 9/11, 2001, when I felt compelled to do something to create some healing in the world across cultures, across nations, across countries. And the idea to bring Israelis, Palestinians, and American teens together for leadership training appeared in that space.
I know, obviously, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict runs incredibly deep and is rooted through generations and millennia, really, if you want to go further back. Are teenagers generally super willing and open to having conversations at that age, as opposed to some of the adults maybe that are more rooted in their positions?
Teenagers are the ideal demographic to have these hard conversations. We work with 15, 16, 17-year-olds during their first time in the program. And I'm always blown away at how thoughtful they are and how willing they are to go deep and have very genuine and very challenging conversations and to be changed very quickly by really understanding an opposing point of view. So teens are our ideal audience.
Is it the idea that get them to chat with each other, understand something perhaps before the clay hardens? You know what I mean? Like before they get to an age where maybe those conversations, I don't want to say they're too late because getting people in a room together to talk, I don't think you can ever be too old for that and changing minds, but at an age where maybe that's just more likely.
Well, I think you expressed that very well. We are open to encouraging dialogue with any demographic, teens, adults, and we foster that. But really, there is a point in life where the young people seem to be open to what might appear on the surface to be radically new ideas and to embrace them. And they're not jaded by life yet. So they are open to thinking about the world differently, even if they came with a really embedded narrative that they've grown up with. They've only seen the conflict through one lens. in a very short period of time through facilitated dialogue, they're able to go from what I call black and white thinking to the much more nuanced gray thinking that we could all benefit from.
Chatting with Gretchen Grad, Hands of Peace founder. Was the idea to include American teens in this simply because, well, we're here in the United States, we're bringing people here for this, let's include some American teens in there? Or was it intentional to give American teens a perspective on what happens on the other side of the world, too?
It was intentional. The work that we do creates change agents out of these young people who become passionate and have the skill set to really be involved in their home communities. So that's a skill that could work for anybody. So American teens could also benefit from that. But it really stems from the timing of the start of the program, which, as I said, was in the wake of September 11th. I was really struck by how ignorant many Americans were about American foreign policy in the world and how what the decisions that our political leaders make really impact lives around the world. So it was important to me to have Americans in those dialogue rooms, in those conversations, meeting their peers from a conflict-laden area of the world that really were very involved in. So it was very intentional.
And how does it actually work? It's what, 3 weeks you get people together in a couple different areas? What are the specs on how this plays out?
Yeah, so it kicks off with a summer program that's 3 weeks in length, and we bring Israelis and Palestinians from the Middle East. They travel here to Chicago, and also we have a second site in San Diego. So for 3 weeks in the summer, happens in July, they come and they live with host families, so they're getting a taste of what American life is inside and outside the classroom. And for the duration of those 3 weeks, the mornings are spent in very intensive dialogue sessions, and this is where we have trained facilitators who help them. But this is not about sitting in a circle holding hands and singing kumbaya. This is really where they get a chance to tell the stories of their struggles, their suffering, the perspective that they feel the other side has no idea about. So that happens in the morning. They have lunch together. Afternoon is typically could be an activity like a high ropes course to build teamwork and trust exercises. It could be cultural outings in Chicago or in San Diego. And then in the evening, sometimes we have designated host family time, so they get a chance to really get to know and bond with the families that are hosting them. And sometimes we have larger group activities. We bring up to 45 young people to Chicago and 45 to San Diego each summer. So you can imagine when we get the host families together and the volunteers that are so important to our work and the staff together, you know, it's a 100-person-plus gathering every time we get together.
And it's a huge operation. And I don't want to leave without mentioning that you have obviously a need to pay for this, and you hope to raise about $157,000. You've got the benefit, the Hands of Peace Chicago benefit at the Chevy Chase Country Club, Power of Purple, on Sunday, May 7th. And there's an online auction for tickets to the Taylor Swift Eras Tour, open now at handsofpeace.org. Gretchen, it's important stuff. Thanks for joining us, okay?
Thanks for the opportunity to spread the word.
Absolutely.